Hello, One Song Nation. Diallo and Luxury here.
Hello.
Just a quick note before we start the show. We're splitting our Dab Punk episode into two parts.
That's right, Diallo. We made that decision because we had so much to say about Toma and Gimon and Get Lucky that we needed a little more time and space.
That's right. Time and space for all the fun facts, Easter eggs, samples, stems, robot helmets, pyramids, all that good stuff.
All of it. This is part one. We're going to cover the genesis and early years of the band and take you all the way up to their triumphant Coachella performance.
That's right.
In part two, we'll get into the stems for Get Lucky, and trust me, you'll want to stick around for all of it.
Whether you're a longtime super fan of the band, or this is your first time and you want to see what all the hubbub was about, we've got the information for you. All right, let's do this. Enjoy the show. Thanks to the U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Just like notes in a song, sustainable living is just a series of small eco-friendly choices that contribute to the melody. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on At Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Luxury, what's up, my man?
Sorry, that was a robot voice. I could tell what you were trying to do. I get it.
I'm sorry, dude. I'm so amped. I'm so excited. Today we are talking about a band that Luxury and I love and are honestly kind of obsessed with. I mean, there's probably a restraining order. In fact, the biggest FOMO moment of my entire life came from missing their legendary Coachella performance in 2006.
And I did not miss that performance. I was there that night. I saw it.
I hate you.
I'm so sorry. So sorry, not sorry, but it was pretty incredible. It's everything you've heard was true. And it was a live set that shifted the landscape of pop music and brought dance to the masses. We're going to talk about that night and Diallo's FOMO a little later on the episode.
Must we?
But first, let's say a little more about today's song. After its release in the spring of 2013, it went to number one in the UK, Australia, Belgium, Germany, Luxembourg.
Luxembourg! It went number one in Luxembourg.
That's really saying something.
That's at least a dozen people felt like it needed to be number one.
No Luxembourg shade. I won't have it. It was pretty much number one everywhere around the world. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
God.
Except for here in the U.S., where it was beaten out by Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines.
It did, however, win a Grammy, and it was not just any Grammy. It was the Grammy for Record of the Year. And Rolling Stone, they're never wrong, ranked it as one of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Rolling Stone, I'm coming for you. And also, unlike Blurred Lines, it didn't get anybody sued.
An important distinction, it's true,
yes,
to be sure. This time, on One Song, we're up all night for good fun, and we're up for Daft Punk's Get Lucky. I'm up all night to get some. She's up all night for good fun. I'm up all night to get lucky. We're up all night to the sun. We're up all night to get some. We're up all night for good fun.
I'm actor, writer, director, and sometimes robot, Diallo Riddle.
And I'm producer, DJ, and songwriter, Luxury, a.k.a. the guy who talks about
interpolation.
Interpolation.
On TikTok.
There you go.
I'm so happy I brought that today. So, Get Lucky drops in 2013. Diallo, what is going on in your world back then, and how did you first hear the song?
Oh, man. I'm full-on writing mode. We had just left Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, and we were starting to work with people like Maya Rudolph and Drake. Drake was getting ready to host the ESPYs in a little bit, and so we were working with him. And so there were a lot of drives up to Calabasas. But, you know, I was just like everybody else. I remember that Steve Aoki put out a tweet on an app called Twitter back then, and it said something to the effect of, you know, can't wait for this Daft Punk album because to me they are God, you know. Yeah. And I knew exactly what Steve was talking about. Like, the anticipation
wasn't
level
wrong.
Was through
he
the
wasn't
roof.
Wrong. The anticipation was through the roof. That's absolutely true. Yeah, no, I'll never forget because I remember there was everyone who was at Coachella. That's how it was announced. At Coachella, they had like a giant billboard where they just played that 2-minute snippet from the video,
yeah,
right?
To fall, to
And so I was getting texts left and right. It was on the internet. It was being tweeted, like you said.
Yeah.
And I just remember when I first heard the song itself, I had just put out a record and I was thinking about my next music. And I was thinking in a similar vein, sort of 70s disco, California vibes.
Yeah.
And I was like, God damn it. Daft Punk beat me to it. There's no chance in hell I'm going to compete with that. Not that there was any competition that could have been had, but...
Well, what I think is interesting about that is that I think that you have to remember in 2013, there is arguably no hotter music or sound than EDM.
Right.
Like, EDM has completely taken over, you know, you could argue pop music. It's you know, it's the music
the
of Las Vegas.
Absolutely.
Like,
it's huge.
DJs are signing $14 million. I think Hakkasan signed Deadmau5 to a $14 million deal.
It's the sound of planet Earth in 2013.
I mean, like Afrojack, Avicii.
Right.
Everybody
Swedish
is
House
making
Mafia. Big
huge,
dollars.
Swedish House Mafia.
Big dollars.
Huge money.
Big
huge
dollars.
Rooms.
Right.
So much excess. And this is the moment that the people who you can argue popularized this music, this electronic dance music, Daft Punk, the granddaddies, they're coming back with a new album, and everybody's like, what is it going to sound like? How do you go any bigger?
And I totally
than
get
it
too.
Sounds?
We're going to get into it on this episode, but I totally got it because in that moment, I, like so many people, were maybe exhausted hearing those similar sounds.
Yeah.
So I was like, I don't want to make that. I was making dancey music. I was doing remixes. Again, I'm not comparing myself to Daft Punk. This is not my John Lennon Jesus moment. but I am saying that I understood the vibe that led them to make this very controversial decision after pioneering this sound to not do the sound anymore.
They have a long, long history of not doing what is expected of them and sort of going the other direction.
That's right.
And we're going to get into that. But this album is in some ways absolutely in keeping with their habit of saying, no, not going to do what you want us or expect us to do.
Yeah. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me, as they famously sing in their famous song. Wait, that's not them?
That's not them.
Oh, my bad.
That's a different group. Luxury, why don't you start us off with a brief biography of Thomas and Guimond?
I'm going to take you back to Paris, France, in the 1980s, when a young gentleman named Thomas Bangalter meets another young gentleman named Guy Manuel de Homem-Christo, who from...
Nice job.
Heretofore...
Nice job. From, so many of us avoid that full name.
From this point forward, we're going to call him Guimond and Thomas. Thomas and Guimond meet. They form a band with Laurent Brankowitz.
Yes.
It's called Darlin'.
Yes.
You want to say something about
this?
Yes,
well, I think this is a very fascinating thing. So, okay, so Darlin' is named ironically, well, not even ironically, it's named after a Beach Boys song called Darlin'. And Darlin' sounds like this. No, if words could say.
So they're California dreaming
that's
already.
What they were surf guys. Yeah. They were trying to make surf pop. And so that's the Beach Boys. Darlin' is only around for about 6 months. And they came up with a song called Cindy So Loud. Here is the demo for Darlin'. And the song is called Cindy So Loud.
Just screams demo to me when I hear this. I'm like, oh, this is a demo. This is a four-track Tascam demo tape.
You know, you can't always hear the greatness on everybody's demo. So that is the first song that Guimond and Thomas ever put out with their friend Laurent, who goes on to be a founding member of the band Phoenix.
That's right. Yeah. Two seminal bands came.
Two seminal
out of
groups
this one.
Out of France.
By the way, I'd say Darlin'. They dropped the G. Darlin'.
Yes.
Darlin'. Very American. I really love that demo, by the way, because it gives us such like demo vibes of like a teenage
totally.
Band who send this with stars in their eyes to the Melody Maker, who calls it a Daft Punky Thrash, which is the origins of the band's name in their second chapter. There's one more track I want to play from that same demo, because it actually has the seeds of what's about to happen next. This is Untitled 18. So I don't know if you recognize that, but do you recognize that?
That's a sample.
That is,
and that is, what is that, SWAT? Is that the theme from SWAT? What is that?
It's actually not the theme from SWAT, but I totally hear what you're hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar kind of like urgency to it, but it's from this. That was crazy, cosmic time. There's a star. Maybe I got a Bowie sample. Early days, they're playing with sampling and samples. And,
yeah, what's cool is that's the first song where you hear sampling coming into their repertoire.
And that's where they're like, hey, we kind of like this better than this punk rock thing. And that's the direction they go down that path.
This might have been their first foray into music, but music's kind of in their blood. Tell us about Tomas' dad.
Perfect timing to step back for a minute and talk about a sort of unsung third member of this band. Yep. That's been a theme recently, is talking about the behind-the-scenes people that were big influences. So in this case, it's Daniel Vanguard, a.k.a. Daniel Bangalter, Tomas' dad, who himself in the 70s was a fairly well-known French artist and producer and songwriter. In the 70s, he wrote over 350 songs. His output, his catalog is incredible. It's very eclectic. And he was experimenting with a lot of like exotic rhythms and instruments and really cool eclectic catalog.
Yeah.
So Daniel Vanguard is making all these incredible songs in the early 70s in France, but his mind is blown after he's in a French club in a Parisian disco and he hears this song for the first time. That is obviously
Chic's
Le Freak, a little foreshadowing of another member who we're going to be talking about.
That's definitely never coming back into play.
That's not going to come back into the story.
Exactly.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Yeah. So a little foreshadowing of Nile Rodgers is going on there, the guitar player and songwriter for the band Chic. At this point, he changes his direction and doubles down on disco. Becomes a huge disco fan, produces a whole bunch of great tracks, including a couple that I'll play for you now. This is the Gibson Brothers from 1979. This track is called Cuba. Or Cuba. So he's making disco records. He's loving it. He's a huge disco fan. Like, he's a believer, like, deep in his soul that it's music that brings people
disco
together.
Disco devotee.
He's a disco devotee. That's right.
That was the name of my first group.
Disco really?
No.
That's pretty great.
I know. We should use that.
We should definitely use that. It's definitely a song, if nothing else. When Disco Demolition happens in Chicago in 1979, he's very upset by it. He goes, I felt crazy that people will say this will stop. It's a rhythm. You can't stop people dancing to a rhythm.
You can't stop the rhythm.
So he wrote this song kind of as a tribute to, like, that disco will never die.
Yeah.
This is Ottoan, D-I-S-C-O, from 1979.
I can't spell.
And by the way, just one more thing I want to point out about his music, which is relevant, because
I want to point out something about disco.
Ahead. Okay, start with that.
Disco, D-I-S-C-O, dot, you know, periods in between, like it's an acronym.
Like it's an acronym, right.
Stand My first exposure to Daft Punk, real exposure to them, was in the summer of 2000, I was an intern at Virgin Records. And so we had a lot of really
came
cool.
Out on the record label.
They came out with a collection of their music videos, and the collection was called "A Story of Dogs, Androids, Firemen, and Tomatoes."
Right. All
so
the stars
I thought
of all
Daft Punk stood for dogs, androids, firemen, and tomatoes.
What? I never made that connection.
Did I blow your mind just now?
I never.
By
made
the way,
that
one
connection.
Of the coolest things I own. And this is for all the people watching on YouTube. You can see me struggle. Bring this up. This is a really rare shirt. I can say that we had a whole box of these at Virgin Records
Oh, man.
Year.
I'd love to find that box.
This is a Daft Punk t-shirt. I have gone looking for it.
That's valuable.
On eBay.
That is expensive.
I have seen it nowhere. It is the official Dafton Direct Tour Daft Punk Live t-shirt, and you can see where they were playing in the summer and the, I guess it's like the summer of, it's all 97. This is like from February to April 1997, but I went look.
And if
you're
the fifth caller, this is yours.
Dude, this is
1-800.
This is my
one song. Actually, that's a perfect 1-800 number.
Last deviation, 1997, driving down the street, I see my friend Danny Passman
Danny Passman,
whose dad is a famous
Is it
attorney.
Don Passman?
Donald Passman, yeah.
The guy who wrote the book on record industry law. I know exactly.
So
everyone knows that
book. His son, Danny, was a college classmate of mine. And I was driving down Sunset, and I saw him on the side of the street. I think it was outside the House of Blues or something. I've been trying to find out where this location, but I just know I saw him. And I was like, Danny, what are you standing in line for? He's like, oh, we're going to go see Daft Punk tonight. You want to go? And I was like, oh, I've heard of them. Nah, I think I'll just keep driving. And I did. And so that was the first time that I missed out, because I could have seen Daft Punk live in Los Angeles in 1997.
The FOMO of Daft Punk. No, I love this. I love the fact that, too, this is a band that kind of generates that kind of that moment of like, where were you when X kind of band.
They were just cool from the beginning.
I'll never forget the first time I heard it. I was working in New York City, and a guy called Stuart Matson, who's the head of planning at my ad agency, and he was the guy that was always like the cool hunter. Like on his job at the agency was to know what was going on.
Know what was cool.
What's the new cool shoe? What's the new cool whatever? And he walked into my office and he put a CD in my machine. He's like, listen to this. And he played me Homework. I never heard it before.
He played it on CD.
Yeah. And that moment is burned into my brain because that was my first exposure to one of my now, for these last 20 years, favorite bands.
Yeah.
More than 20 years? Oh my God, 30 years.
No. It's been
a while. It's been 20. Okay, Jesus.
97.
I had to do the
math.
That's
almost 30 years ago.
It's been a while. But we both have 1997 memories of the first exposure.
The first time you heard that name. Yeah, it was a catchy name. Oh my gosh, so much to talk about. I love where this is going. More on Daft Punk after this break. Thanks to the U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Just like notes in a song, sustainable living is just a series of small, eco-friendly choices that contribute to the melody. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on At Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
One more thing I want to play from you from, this is another Daniel Vanguard, a.k.a. Thomas from Daft Punk's dad.
Mm-hmm.
Another one of his tracks. I think this is really interesting. He's in his disco phase. Check out this song. It's called Dancing Machine. We'll talk about it on the other side. So, first of all,
that tune is so cool.
It's a cool track.
Yeah.
And you're basically hearing the two words dancing machine for the entire song, 6 minutes long.
Repetition.
You know exactly where I'm going with this.
Yes, I like it already.
I feel like the dad's influence is not just in the disco, it's also in the specific way the songs are written. And there's one more thing that he brings to the table for young Thomas, is that his music industry experience ends pretty poorly. He has a really bad experience where he feels incredibly disillusioned. He had this moment where he has a bitter experience with the French music industry when he discovers that a lot of royalties were stolen from Jewish composers during the Nazi occupation of France. He goes down the path of fighting for the rights of their ancestors, for their intellectual property rights, for the money that was stolen from them. And the official report comes out and sort of denies anything ever happened.
Mm.
They never pay anybody. And after that, he is so disillusioned. This is one of a few steps that leads him to just completely abandon the music industry and his entire music career. In one fell swoop, he's like, this is it, I'm out. And that is something he takes to his young son and his friend who are starting a band, saying, do not let them mess with you.
Oh, that's cool.
He advises them. He gets a thank you credit on their first record. He advises them about hold on to control.
Mm.
Don't tell them what you're going to do. Only you can know artistically what your direction is going to be in life. So
I mean,
that was a very valuable lesson.
If you know the story about Daft Punk, that is definitely a fundamental through line of their whole career. Like, you know, they famously said to the label, we get to decide what the cover art for Homework is going to be.
100% of
you
the
guys
way.
Don't.
All the control.
They
the
were like,
the
they're very early on in their career. They're like, we're not doing any more of these pictures. you know, like we don't want to take any pictures. Like we're going to be, you know, completely in charge of our output. And we also don't want you to like, no offense to the Nightcrawlers, which is like a seminal, you know, house group, but they're like, we're not the Nightcrawlers. We don't want to see Dab Punk 2000 and we had nothing to do with it. You know, like they were very controlling of pretty much every bit of their process.
Absolutely. And it's not like a prima donna from thing the beginning. Where like arrogant. I suppose there's a lot that goes into that.
They actually care.
I mean, and no small part of it feels to me at least like having their father's experience clearly informed their confidence that this is the way to have a successful and sane career. I think the dad is probably no small part of why they've treated their career completely differently than the average.
Yes, they were always completely hands-on and... You know, we're going to get into it, but like they've turned down so much money so many times.
Oh my God, working
so
with
much
like,
money so
like,
many times.
Like, you know, Stardust
was supposed to have an album.
Yeah.
And the labels
millions
came to them. They were offered $3 million to record the Stardust album. They're like, no, we did Music Sounds Better with You. We're done. We're good. We're not gonna do that.
We
album.
Are definitely gonna talk about that song. So, that's a big important song.
So I'm gonna walk us through the 90s with this group. So eventually they find out that, you know, with their friends, they have this love of American Chicago house and Detroit techno music. I want to say to anybody listening to this show, one of my favorite movies about music, and definitely my favorite movie about DJing, is a French film called Eden. Mia Hansen-Love directed it. And
I thought you were going to say that Zac Efron one. No,
oh,
kidding.
Gosh.
I didn't think
we are your friends.
That.
No, Fitz, I actually have a friend who pops up in that one. I'm going to leave that one alone. But Eden, E-D-E-N, French film, 2014, I believe. It is so good. It talks about the relationship of not just the DJ with the music, but the crowd with the music in such in such amazing, artistically sound ways. The Dab Punk licensed their music to it for the absolute lowest possible amount, which was $3,000. They licensed their entire music.
They loved it.
To this That's movie for $3,000. And
very
it's
generous.
Because they have this composite character. They have three characters in the movie. They have a composite character that represents sort of the people who they used to party with when they were teenagers and young adults. And these two guys are supposed to be the members of Dab Punk. And then they go off and they become Dab Punk. And this composite character he rises to the high level of being the manager of the bar where they all met. And then at one point they all come back to town. They're like, hey, how you been? He's like, oh, I'm managing the bar. But over the course of the movie, you see how the music goes from, you know, that sort of like them trying to sound like their heroes, Paul Johnson and all those people who they name check on the song Teachers, to they go through the electro phase and the Ed Banger phase of music, which, you know, to those who don't know, is like a sort of like I've heard it called stadium anthemic electronica. And all the way to, you know, roughly when the movie was made, 2014, about the time that Dab Punk comes out with this song. But I do want to walk you quickly through some of their early releases, because some of them don't sound like Dab Punk songs at all. This was the very first song that they ever came out with. This is a single called The New Wave, and I'm just going to play a snippet. So you can see they start off with a really sort of like hard, sort of dark techno sound, but it starts to take off and people start hearing some of their songs. Defunk was the song that sort of broke them really big. Like the Chemical Brothers heard it, they worked it into their set. Richie Houghton heard it, he was like, this song is amazing. This is a time when like the BPM on music is like 127 to 130 BPM. That song clocks in at a cool, what, 116, 112? Like it's a very slow song.
Yeah.
With Defunk and Musique and other songs blowing up, they finally released their first album, which we said they told the label, hey, we have to control every little bit of this album. And it comes out at a unique time in France, because this is around the time that there's a certain sound in French music, especially French dance music.
Yeah, let's
French
talk
Touch.
About it. French Touch comes out of house music. Some of the early pioneers, you know, Cassius and Alan Brax, who we're going to talk about
Cassius,
later on.
Cassius, R.I.P. That was such a tragic passing in 2019, right before his new album came out, too.
Yeah, Philippe Zadar passed away.
Yeah.
A great producer, did Phoenix, among other things. But they pioneered this sort of interesting new version of house, or I would say builds on house music, which uses the 909 beats.
Yep.
And the tempos are often faster, but really the new innovations are the way looping is done starts to be like a little bit more repetitious. And more specifically, there's these DJ effects and actual like,
let's talk about the filter.
We're going to talk about filters. We're going to talk about minimalism and repetition. All of this stuff finds its way into this very French version of the way house music is coming out.
Yeah, I mean, like, I love French touch. I mean, like, I will say like, it's got the house influences, obviously, but then there's also there's the filtered disco sound, taking like those disco songs.
Well, a lot
and
of it specifically
it.
Is the sound of a DJ using their DJ tools, which is EQ cuts and filter sweeps in the recorded music.
As a DJ, I'm not above a good filtering moment.
I think that's one of the big innovations of the genre, which makes it sort of next level. Is it takes into account like house music comes out and DJs play it. French touch is kind of like, let's record a little bit of what we've been doing in the clubs.
It's the same thing as when hip hop songs have the, you know, no Keisha Cole on the Keisha Cole record.
Yeah,
you know
exactly.
what I mean? Like where they got the bah, 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 bah on the record.
Right.
It's just using the DJ tools on the actual recording.
Right. It's exactly what it is. And one great example of this, and by the way, we should note that at this point in around 97, 98, both Guimon and Thomas have their own record labels that they form.
Yes.
Guimon comes out with Creedamore. Bongalter is Roulet.
And I am going to state for the record, Roulet is one of my favorite
record
it's labels
very
of
you.
All freaking time.
Roulet is
Outrun,
very yellow.
Outrun is one of my favorite songs. I often will say, oh, guys, we got to play this Daft Punk song called Outrun. I always forget that that's actually just Thomas.
Yeah, it does feel, well, it definitely feels
like... But it feels
like
a Daft Punk song.
Can we play
a second of Outrun?
Please do. I consider the collective output of these labels, too, to be part of their catalog.
Fair enough. Here's a little bit of Outrun by Bangalter, another really hard song, but just lovable.
There's that filtering. That's like literally a DJ doing this, the Pioneer mixer.
So like it's a hard techno-y song, but like I'm telling you, when you play that song to this day, it goes hard.
Right, and it's literally like a lot of what you're hearing, and the effects are what are on a DJ mixer. You'd be able to do that filter sweep, where the sound kind of goes in and out, and that's a way of when you have a loop that's going through the whole song, it's a way to keep it interesting.
Yeah,
to keep it dynamic.
Absolutely. And the French touch artists are like some of my favorite artists of all time. You have Etienne de Crécy.
Oui.
Who is one of my favorite. He did the Super Discount albums for a little bit. And
Alex
then,
Gopher.
Alex Gopher. He has a song called, I think it's You and Me. Like, I don't play it anymore, but like, to this day, if I can ever slip that into a set, I feel accomplished. Ian Pooley, I would throw in the mix there. And by the way, Ian Pooley's song, Chord Memory, is one of the first songs that Daft Punk did a remix for. Yeah. And that song it's sort of a seminal French touch song. Here's a really brief second of Chord Memory by Ian Pooley. So you hear that bass line, you hear that repetition with the vocal.
I just want to say that it's funny hearing all of these songs out of the context of the club, because on our show, we're usually playing, you know, songs that are vocally driven. But it's important to understand that for Daft Punk as producers and the sort of musical output aspect and how they formed their sounds, so much of it is about this repetition. It's about being in the club. It's about the bass.
Yes.
It's about the trance. Like, you know, if you're going till 6 a.m,
yes,
this is what
you
it feels like.
You have to work
like
yourself up into a trance.
And so the repetition of it, this is one of the innovations, I would say, of French touch, is like you can extend a song for 10 minutes with one sample and one beat with just kind of things coming and going. That's an accomplishment.
Now, whenever you label any genre a name, big beat, French touch, garage rock, inevitably there is going to be one track that is kind of recognized as the seminal track in the genre. And
we agree.
Tell us about Stardust. Music
oh my
sounds
God.
Better with
this
you.
This is, I mean, let me just say before we go any further, the 1998 song by Stardust, Music Sounds Better With You. I'm controversial here. Might be my favorite Daft Punk song.
Really?
I know it's not technically a Daft Punk. Guimon is not on this. This is Thomas with Alan Brax, who we alluded to earlier.
Yes.
Part of the French touch scene.
And
Benjamin
Diamond
on vocals.
Yeah.
This is Music Sounds
By the way,
Better
shout out to Alan Brax. I think he actually listens to the podcast. He's one of the seminal, you know, one of the really important French producers doing music to this day.
Without further ado, Music Sounds Better With You by Stardust. Baby, timeless.
It's repetitious, but you have to actually listen to it closely to know that like the music does change.
Yeah.
Like, and I noticed you picked the place where the chords
baseline changes.
Yeah, it changes and it gets super like. The phrase that pops in my head is like caramel and brown sugar.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, like
interestingly,
it's really sweet. And you're like, yeah. Ooh, that's nice.
It's beautiful, maybe perfectly put, because actually the chords technically don't change. It's just the bass line.
It's the bass line.
And
okay.
What's happening prior to that bass line change is there's this like tension.
Dun, oh, wait, it's like major. It's like, dun, 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 dun. Play it again.
It's the same
loop. Play that same part you just played.
It's the same loop. It's just the bass line that's changing. Here, I'll play it again.
This is like the part I consider major. But then it does this. That's the part.
Now you're fucking with
That's
me.
That's where it changes.
Oh, you're talking. Okay. This bum, is all bum, fucking
bum,
with me.
Bum, bum, bum. See, that's
normal. I'm wrong. Then, it does change.
And then it goes. But now watch.
Yeah.
It changes. And that's where it's like, oh, snap. It's like it's a little more minor or something. I mean, like, once again, public schools have failed me. I don't know how to speak in this language, but like it goes, it shifts a little bit, and then you're like, oh man, yeah. This is the part.
It's been harmonized. The bass line is harmonizing with those chords to change how you feel.
But I hear dun 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 dun, but then it goes dun 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 dun. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that to me, like the first time I heard that, I was like, oh gosh, this. This music is potent. This music is powerful. You know, like, because I was still listening primarily to hip hop in 98. That was when, like, Puffy and Bad Boy was starting to really take over. So I was looking for some other music to listen to because I didn't like their form of sampling. And then I heard this stuff, which, by the way, there is a very prominent sample here.
Yes.
We both know what it is. It's a song called Fate. It's by Chaka Khan. And it goes like this. That's all they sampled. That was it. They just took that little, what is that? Is
that's
that
two
bars?
That's one bar.
They took that one bar and flipped it into an international hit that is still revered and loved to this day.
So beautiful, absolutely.
And it spawned so many imitators. And here's where we get a little controversial, because I think that I don't mind Mojo, Lady, Can You Hear Me?
And that song comes from is a sample of not the first and not the last
time. I love this sample.
We'll be hearing the name Nile Rodgers and Chic today. Yeah. This is Soup for One from 1982.
Soup for One.
Soup for One. Red look on the run.
One of the hardest jobs in the world is to be a film, like the soundtrack
person.
So the
movie was called Soup for One.
When they have the title.
Yes.
And you've got to work the title into your song.
I know. It's actually wonderful.
It's like that Key and Peele.
It's a forgotten movie, but Soup for
One. Jumanji!
Exactly. So French Touch is, you know, really inundating the airwaves. And our original members of Darling have gone in different directions.
Darling.
Laurent has founded the group Phoenix, which I think, you know, clearly wears its French Touch sound on its sleeve, but it was very cool in the sense that it was more of a indie rock band with disco influences. And for those who don't know, Phoenix did a lot of great songs. The first song I ever heard from them, I was walking down the street in LA, Melrose, and I stopped in a record store, and that was back when, you know, you could pick out a record, cover look cool, put it on the record. You didn't know what it was going to sound like. And I'll never forget, I was at that Melrose record shop, and I heard this, and I immediately fell in love with Laurent's band. This is If I Feel Better by Phoenix.
I feel the chaos around me, a thing I don't try to deny. I better learn to accept that there are things in my life I can't control. They say love is nothing but a sore. I don't even know what love is.
So you can hear the disco influence in that a lot. And Phoenix obviously went on to a very long indie-inspired career. But at the same time, Guimon and Thomas were working on what I consider a pure masterpiece of a record. Not only do we think that Discovery is just an outstanding album, it's so infectious, it really does create this weird zone between pop and dance music where it's like, why was there ever a line there? And it's a great second album. We've talked on the show in the past. If you can nail that second album, that usually cements something. Like if you think about Low End Theory, that was their second, you know, studio album. This is Daft Punk's second for Tribe Called Quest. This is Daft Punk's second studio album, and it really cements the idea of them as the robots. You know, they sort of move away from the French Touch sound entirely and create something that sounds unique and distinctly robotic. And that's going to carry them for most of the rest of their career.
Yeah, this is where they invent and create this idea of them becoming robots. The joke of it for them was that there was an accident in the studio while they were making this record. And from this point forward, you never see them without their masks.
Can I say something about the mask? First off, brilliant on their behalf. They don't have to show up at every show. In fact, there was a great story in that book you gave me that said that I think it was at Fabric. It was at one of the, maybe Heavenly Social. It was at one of the big British you know, like venues, and they basically they didn't show up. Ironically, they left town early because they had to go record with Roman Anthony. They had to go record one more time. Glad they took off and recorded when they did.
Worthwhile.
They didn't show up at the show, so they put two other DJs up there.
It could be anybody.
Nobody knew what Daft Punk looked like.
Brilliant.
And they performed. I will say the first time I ever saw Daft Punk live after missing them in 1997. Was at Nikki Beach. This is back when the Winter Music Conference was like the big deal in dance music every year. Now we have Vegas, Ibiza is still going strong. But back then, Winter Music Conference was a really big deal. And I remember that Daft Punk was DJing on Nikki Beach, and I went to see him. And yeah, there were two guys. I'm pretty sure I actually saw them, the real guys. They were just spinning
records. You saw him in the flesh?
On the beach, yeah.
Just like curly-haired dude and short dude?
Exactly. So as late as 2000, 2001, you could still go see Daft Punk. They didn't have on the mask, but once they're really promoting Discovery, the masks stay on. The robot masks are always there.
They're always there. They really lock into the robot thing. They even make a movie in 2006 called Electroma, which is really great and interesting foreshadowing. It ends with a moment where they blow up their robot personas. 2006 is also the same year of the famous Coachella Pyramid. The
experience you had to bring up sore subjects.
That I had that you did not have, and I am sorry, but I wish I could share it with you. That's a friendly vibe. Hopefully I'm giving off that. I want you to have been there.
To this day, I drag my wife out to things that she doesn't want to go to, and I think somewhere in the back of my mind, it's always that I fear that I'm going to miss out on the next historical moment.
You might.
I'll be like, hey, S.G. Lewis is playing at the Shrine. We gotta go. And she's like, can't we just watch it on YouTube? I'm like, yeah, and I can also watch the Pyramid from 2006 on YouTube. It's not the same if you're not there.
It's not the same if you're not there, no. They did make a record out of it, though, 2007's Alive, and that is the end of their electronic music, I would argue. After this point, they are not making music with computers, and
that's crazy.
They're still using synth, they're still using vocoders, that carries over.
Yeah,
but this brings us to the next phase. And by the way, this is the moment where,
well, can I ask you one Coachella question?
Yeah,
I want to ask you one Coachella. So you're there, are you towards the very front, are you in the back, are you in the middle?
I am probably in the middle. I mean, that's a great question. I have to, like, I have some
can you see the bathrooms? Can you escape to the bathroom if you need?
My memory of being in that tent is just the, like, incredible, like, whoosh of excitement.
Wait, it was in a tent? I thought it was outside.
No, it was in the tent. Okay. It was in the whatever that tent is called. I can't remember names.
I'm just trying to live through you, my man.
Yeah. My memory of it is that it was just
Did you feel the history being made? Like, did you feel it? Were you like, this is next level?
I'll tell you one thing about the 2007 record. It does convey some of the energy. When I listen back to it, it really does remind me.
Yeah, Alive 2007. Great album for those who want to know what it was like.
Like, even now I'm getting kind of chills.
Yeah.
Right?
Robot. Robot.
That was, I'm getting chills now, and I was in the room at the time. The excitement of that moment was, the simplicity of it was devastating. Like, they had a pyramid. It's two guys, you can't see their faces, and they're robots. But the magic of the music being familiar, because these are tracks we all knew and loved going into it, the excitement that Daft Punk, I'd never seen them before, like, there was a buzz about it. That was all, that was the energy of that moment.
Can I just say real quick, just one last thing about Coachella. I had been at every Coachella since the very first one, 1999. Coachella was a one-day event. And I drove out to the desert by myself because I wanted to see the Chemical Brothers and Underworld. Beck was the headliner. That's a great lineup. Beck was the headliner, but I wanted to see the Chemical Brothers and Underworld. Two things happened. One, I realized that I loved, because I drove, I realized that I loved electronic music without any drugs, and I was completely sober. I'm sure that everybody around me was completely messed up. In fact, one guy I'm pretty sure was 100% messed up. But I was sober, and I loved Underworld, and I thought that was a great show. I remember walking over to the Chemical Brothers, passing Beck, and they were performing songs off of the album Surrender. And there's a song called Music Response on there.
Oh, yeah. It's a similar vibe to that one, isn't it?
It's like music, response, music that triggers some kind of response.
Right.
And I'll never forget when it was going music response, it was robots in black and white, cartoon robots on their big screen. And then when it went to music that triggers some type of response, when the beat came in, the robots, they came alive in color. And I remember thinking, robots in color! And I was sober. Exciting. But I was just like, this is insane! And so I feel like there's something about this music and humanity and robots where it's like the opposite of how I feel about AI sometimes. Like I feel like it's in some ways the perfect marriage of what makes us human with a little bit of just spice and flavor of robots, you know, and just that robotic voice.
I think that's what Daft Punk was playing with their whole career leading up to this pinnacle moment, literally the pinnacle being at the tip of a pyramid at Coachella in 2006.
Oh, and my God,
At the peak, literally. And this maybe is the moment where they decided that the balance should go in the other direction.
Yeah, you make a great point, because the song that we have been building up towards this entire time is Get Lucky. And it's on Random Access Memories, an album that is unlike almost any Daft Punk album, live album, remix album, any other album. This is an album that is so unlike them in some ways, because it's made with organic instruments. There's we're going to talk about it. There's almost no sampling to talk about. Like, it almost feels like an anti Daft Punk album.
So in 2008, they started working on their fourth record, Random Access Memories. And it's kind of interesting to think about the fact that they were offered an opportunity to do the soundtrack to Tron in 2010, which they did. And that seems to have made a pretty big impression on this record, because it was after that, it really opened their mind about using actual instruments and, you know, moving away from this global dance revolution that they started.
I think a
combination of things happened where they had this experience where they made music in a room with real violin players and real, you know, percussionists and real everything in the symphony orchestral setting. And between that and the fact that what they had been building for many years and pioneered, the EDM sound, as it were, they wanted nothing to do with it.
Yeah, they created the results sound of that. It was almost like French Touch writ large, right? Yeah. So they have a big hand in like defining what French Touch is, and they want nothing to do with it.
They want nothing to do with
it. And then EDM.
The EDM version of it.
Similarly, takes over in ways that French Touch could have never imagined. I mean, like when you've got the guys on the Jersey Shore prioritizing dance music over hip hop or rock and anything else, Fall Out Boy, like, no, dance music's on top of the world. Yeah. You guys, this is your music.
Especially for the generation like ours that grew up post-disco demolition, where especially in America, there was an anti-dance music sentiment.
It was hostile.
That's
but
right.
But like now, they have been, I would say, through One More Time and songs like that, they've help take over the world, and once again, they want nothing to do with it.
So 2008, they start making their next record. They're inspired by, according to Billboard, their desire to make this album was a combination of they're working with live musicians on Tron, and also they just wanted live drums. They wanted to make a record that had a live drummer on it. So it takes 2 years to make, which is spread out over 5 years. It took them from 2008 to 2013 to make. They're inspired by the classic 70s expensive albums like Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon and Fleetwood Mac Rumors. They spent over $1 million on this
record. Todd Rundgren,
Hotel California, all that stuff. The big famous records that sold millions of copies and were pristinely produced.
Yeah.
So they got top-notch studio musicians, very Steely Dan approach of bringing in just the best players. You're going expensive. You're getting a vintage feel with analog sound.
This is actually interesting, because for a long time, Daft Punk, especially in the beginning, they were like, we like to record at our house. They didn't like going to the studio.
Right.
They say this. They're like, we like recording to the house. So, you know, like, in that way, Daft Punk is like Migos, right? Migos recorded their first record in a closet. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. A lot of people say, I'd like to, like, record in my place.
They're ready for the next step. They're ready for not DIY. They're ready to spend money, go to other places, and just and not even touch the music. So much of their first three records are all produced, meaning they made everything. It's producer in the sense of the word, almost the hip-hop electronic sense.
Yeah.
So up until this point, they've been very hands-on and direct. For the first time, they're coming up with ideas in Pro Tools, but then they're saying, hey, guys, hey, top-notch session players here in, I think, Henson Studios in L.A., do something like this, but run with it and see what you come up with. And they're essentially...
Henson Studios?
I think...
I didn't know that. That's actually hilarious, because Henson Studios is like at the corner of La Brea and Sunset. It's got a big Kermit the Frog out there.
Kermit the Frog.
It's literally a block away from A&M Records' old headquarters where, you know, Herb Alpert... and Jerry Moss did their thing. So that it's a crazy that it comes from here.
Yep, exactly. So they record these musicians playing their song ideas that come from just real bare bones, putting together a chord change here, a beat there, a synth part there. And this recorded material becomes the basis of what Daft Punk goes away with and comes up with final songs.
I can't wait to hear these musicians, the improvisations. Don't go anywhere.
Not just any musicians. Yeah, exactly.
We say, seriously, that was. I know that was a lot of setup for the show, but we are about to get into Get Lucky. We are about to talk about this song. Don't go anywhere. Keep listening all night till the sun. I'm up all night to get some. She's up all night for good fun. I'm up all night. We're going to get lucky, and we're going to get into the Get Lucky stems, including Nile Rodgers on guitar and Pharrell on vocals. Luxury, this has been an absolute joy. Help me in this thing.
All right, well, I'm producer, DJ, and songwriter Luxury.
And I'm actor, writer, and happily robot DJ Diala Riddle.
And this has been One Song. We will see you next week. Don't forget to give us 5 stars on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a nice review and tell all your friends. We'll see you next time.
We'll see you next time. You can find us on Instagram at Diala, D-I-A-L-L-O for me.
And I'm at Luxury, L-U-X-X-U-R-Y.
And on TikTok, I'm at Diala Riddle.
And at TikTok, I'm at LuxuryXX.
I like that you got both.
Yeah. Thanks.
All right. Thanks so much, guys. Hey, One Song Nation. A reminder that this is the first part of a 2-part special on Daft Punk. Next week, we'll be back with a deep dive on the song Get Lucky. We'll be talking about how the song was made, including the contributions from Nile Rodgers and Pharrell Williams. We'll also be talking through our favorite Daft Punk samples.
That's right, Diallo. It's a really special episode. We're excited to share it, so tune in next week for part two, or part deux, I should say. This episode was produced by Matthew Nelson, with engineering from Marcus Hom, additional production support from Casey Simonson, and the show was executive produced by Kevin Hart, Mike Stein, Brian Smiley, Eric Eddings, Eric Weil, and Leslie Guam.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.